historian, political analyst, and author, Gilbert Doctorow. Thank you. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين يؤمنون أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it is working on a series of initial steps to counter a recent resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Yemeni armed forces say they have stopped a foreign ship from stealing the nation's oil at a southern port. Plus, Russia calls for restraint after Turkey targets the positions of Kurdish militants in northeastern Syria. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says a series of initial measures have been taken in response to the recent anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The foreign ministry spokesman says the details of the steps will be announced by the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Nasser Kanani says the West's support for the recent anti-Iran resolution showed their will to hinder technical cooperation between Tehran and the UN agency. According to Kanani, Western countries were expected to avoid such politically motivated measures, considering Iran's positive and constructive cooperation with the IAEA. The resolution adopted on Thursday calls on Tehran to fully cooperate with the agency's probe into uranium traces at 3 alleged undeclared sites in Iran. Tehran says the IAEA is basing its statements on information fabricated by Israel. Professor Fuad Izadi from the University of Tehran says the West confrontational approach will backfire in the long run as it gives Iran cold feet in voluntary cooperation with the UN nuclear agency.
You know, I think the real motive behind this resolution is actually to force Iranian officials to stop cooperating with the agency. They want to take the case to the UN Security Council, and by passing this type of politically motivated resolutions. They want to basically create a scene where Iran, given the fact that these type of resolutions are politically motivated, it stops its cooperation with IAEA. In practice, what will happen is that Iran will follow NPT guidelines when it comes to IAEA cooperation, but Iran will do the absolute minimum, nothing more than what is required. Yeah, so this type of practice is actually going to backfire in the long run, because the access, the extra access that Iran was providing under the JCPOA is going to disappear totally, and it's going to be the other side that's going to lose the access that they had more than what Iran was supposed to do. And if they push further, I think Iranian officials will take extra measures to make sure that anti-Iran resolutions has a cost for the countries that sponsor.
Along with other hardships, the poor in Afghanistan have difficulty providing winter fuel to warm their shelters. A number of them have received wood and coal from Iranian embassy in Kabul. Abdullah Mirazadeh reports from the Afghan capital.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aids are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires, and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Yemeni army says it has thwarted an attempt by an enemy tanker to plunder the country's oil in the south. In a series of tweets, the army spokesman said the ship was on a mission to steal, quote, enormous amounts of oil from the port of Aldaba. Yahya Sari added that Yemeni armed forces adequately dealt with the ship after it refused to heed warnings. He further vowed that the Yemeni armed forces would continue to protect the country's resources. In recent weeks, Yemen says that it has foiled at least two other attempts by the Saudi-led coalition to loot its oil. Yemenis say that the Saudi-led coalition looted more than $13 billion worth of the country's oil between 2016 and 2021. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Russia urges Turkey to exercise restraint in using excessive military force in Syria after Ankara launched airstrikes against Kurdish militants in the country. Russian media cited an envoy to Syria as saying that Moscow hopes to convince Ankara to prevent tensions on Syrian territory from escalating. Alexander Lavrentiev reportedly said that Russia would help settle what he called the Kurdish issue peacefully. On Sunday, Turkey conducted airstrikes against bases of Kurdish Workers' Party PKK in Iraq and their affiliate YPG in northeastern Syria. The offensive came days after a bomb hit Istanbul, leaving scores of casualties. Ankara blamed the PKK for the attack, but the Kurdish militants deny any involvement. The Turkish president has also threatened to launch a ground offensive against Kurdish militants in Syria. During our news review program, we discussed Iran's missile and drone attacks on bases of Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review section. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's carried out fresh drone and missile strikes against neighboring Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC says that the strikes targeted the remaining positions of terrorists and separatist groups operating against Iran. The force says that the raids hit locations deep into the Kurdistan region and destroyed their targets. According to the IRGC, the attacks dealt a heavy blow to the terrorists. The force has carried out three rounds of such strikes in northern Iraq recently. Iran says that Iraq's federal government has a responsibility to prevent any threats coming from the Arab country's northern Kurdistan region. Now, allow me to invite a couple of guests to see what they think about that. We have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London. Also with us is Faraz Al Najm, manager with the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights in Toronto. Now, Mohsen Abbas, this is the umpteenth time I remember announcing here myself Iran giving warning to Iraq, both the central government and the Kurdistan region, against allowing Iraqi soil to turn into a hub for terrorist operations and for any threat or menace coming Iran's way from inside Iraqi soil. But unfortunately, no practical action. Promises have been made lots of times. But no practical action on the ground. And this is, I don't know how many times, but IRIB has been doing this recently, and they say that they have to do it because they are entitled to provide and ensure security for Iran. Let's have your thoughts on this.
Well, it's getting increasingly crucial. It has, of course, been a long-running situation, this problem within the Kurdish region. And Iran, as you rightly say, has been trying to have it resolved to no avail, it seems. And now, as they say, the chickens are coming home to roost, because it's that very corridor of the Iraqi Kurdistan region where a lot of the weapons, a lot of the supplies, and a lot of the current insurgents as well within Iran are taking huge support through basically. And what's the background to this region's connections to the enemies of Iran? Well, that's really important. And I people often don't maybe cite this, but Israel has a huge presence in this northern Iraqi Kurdistani region. And they've had it for decades. 1931 was the earliest Israeli connection with the Kurds through Reuven Shiloh, who was the future Mossad director, who actually laid the grounds for most of the alliances they have in that region. The 1950s saw the Israelis come up with the periphery doctrine, which meant Israel would make friends with all of the non-Arab peoples around or surrounding the Arabs, and the Odin-Yinon plan in 1982 consolidated mm-hmm. this. Kurdish-Israeli relations are very warm economically as well as militarily. It's been time and time, I mean, Seymour Hersh, for instance, was one journalist who exposed that the Israelis were training Kurds on the ground. And there are known to be Israeli corporate companies working on, for instance, Erbil Airport and other signs of Israeli interference within that region. All of this means basically Israel has been not only destabilizing Iraq through these Kurdish forces, who they've been encouraging with the temptation of a Kurdish state in the not-too-distant future, and they're also destabilizing Iran, and as you can see, Turkey and Syria are also affected. But they're playing a lot of the Turkish groups off each other as well, and using different ones for different operations. And the ones that are dealing with Iran, well, the IRGC has gone after them yet again this week, and with again, a warning. In the long run, could it be that Iran needs to carry out an actual on-the-ground military operation to clear out those Israeli-backed Kurds who are basically creating insurgencies and huge insurrectionist problems for Iran as well now, as well as Iraq?
Okay. Now, Francois Nejem, how do you look at this issue? From what angle? And who do you think is sponsoring all those terrorist operations that are happening from inside Iraqi SWAT in the Kurdistan region? Because, you know, Iran-Iraq have good and brotherly ties, but this is happening.
Yes, you know, it's clear if you look at the history of Mas'ud Barzani, the one leading the north of Iraq, so-called Kurdistan region. He's had a lot of relations with Saddam at, in the earlier stage, and he's very friendly with the Americans. And also, it's well known that he's very friendly with the Israelis, and there's a lot of Israeli companies and organizations working inside the north of Iraq. And the Iraqi government has spoke against this many times, and certain MPs have spoken against this and threatened also military action. And at a certain point, also he tried to cause sedition by separating the north of Iraq from Iraq, and he did a referendum. It was like a plot. It was kind of like a scheme that he wanted to do really quick, and he failed miserably at that time because the Iraqi army and the popular mobilization forces, mobilized really quick and stopped this type of sedition and type of division in the Middle East, West Asia, as Sayyid Khamenei calls it. So, you know, the north of Iraq, you know, it's a project that's trying to prop up and spread this project all over the different countries, such as Iran and Turkey. They want to separate Kurdish, areas where, they're predominantly Kurdish there, and they're inflaming and also empowering them by the West. Like, they're supporting these separatists and these people that are terrorist organizations, such as PKK and different organizations. And that's why Turkey continuously hits them. That's why Iran continuously hits them. And Iraq is always under threat because of their, evil acts and so on. And hopefully this evil project of building this, Kurdistan region and separating from the whole, from each country will be dismantled, hopefully. And the IRGC are doing a great job at fighting terrorism, inside Iran right now, terrorist groups that are empowered by the West and also empowered by the north of Iraq based there through the system inside the north of Iraq. At the same time, they fought fiercely against the terrorists in Syria, and they also helped and secured Iraq by fighting ISIS. So, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps are really an anti-terrorist organization and force. Unfortunately, the West paints them as their terrorist organization. It's the total opposite. And, this is just a manipulation and a fabrication for an evil agenda of the West to dominate and divide and conquer the whole region. But the IRGC force is very, very powerful, and hopefully they will deal with the situation.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Said Mohsen Abbas in London, Faraz al-Najm in Toronto with our comments and contribution.
Moscow says it has currently no plans to call up more Russian soldiers to fight in the Ukraine war through a second round of mobilization. The Kremlin spokesman did not, however, rule out the possibility of a new round of mobilization in the future. He said that the decision will be left to the Defense Ministry. The mobilization drive was kick-started by President Vladimir Putin back in September and ended a month later. But the official decree that provides the legal basis for the draft is still valid. This has caused concern among some Russian men. Some staged protests while others attempted to flee the country during the first mobilization drive. The draft called up 300,000 Russian reserves to support the Russian military in the war amid a counteroffensive campaign by Ukraine. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration says Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's high office should shield him from a lawsuit over his role in the killing of a U.S.-based journalist, making a turnaround from Joe Biden's passionate campaign trail denunciations of the prince over the brutal slaying. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Responsible State Craft wrote, the Biden administration has moved to grant Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sovereign immunity for his role in ordering the 2018 murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul. The government's determination is non-binding and remains to be reviewed by the judge overseeing the lawsuit brought against MBS by Khashoggi's fiancée, Hatice Cengiz, and the organization Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAN. However, it represents the latest signal that the Biden administration will not hold MBS accountable for the slaying and dismemberment of a U.S. resident. In September, Saudi Arabia announced that the Crown Prince would take on the role of Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, a post ordinarily held by the King. The decision appears to have been primarily motivated by the pending U.S. lawsuit, because, as Prime Minister and thus head of government, MBS is shielded from prosecution. The Crown Prince's new status as Prime Minister arguably grants him sovereign immunity automatically. But the announcement is disappointing in that it reflects a pattern of the U.S. government failing to hold MBS accountable in any way. President Trump actively thwarted congressional efforts to try to punish Saudi Arabia. The global outcry provoked by Khashoggi's brutal murder amplified existing concerns about the U.S. role in supporting the violence and starvation wreaked by the war on Yemen that MBS launched as war minister in 2015. Congress did successfully end mid-air refueling for Saudi and Emirati warplanes dropping bombs on Yemen, but Trump vetoed a congressional war powers resolution that would have ended all U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war. Initially, it seemed that Biden would finally rethink the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Biden had campaigned on making MBS a pariah for his human rights abuses. Yet since taking office, Biden has consistently prioritized continuity in U.S.-Saudi relationship. In February 2021, soon after taking office, the Biden administration declined to hold MBS accountable for Khashoggi's murder, despite releasing the intelligence report that concluded that MBS was indeed responsible. More recently, Biden reversed his stated commitment not to meet with the Crown Prince when he flew to Jeddah in July and fist-bumped the royal in hopes of encouraging the kingdom to pump more oil to offset high prices caused by sanctions on Russia. Instead, OPEC Plus, the oil cartel dominated by Riyadh, announced a production cut of 2 million barrels per day in October. This has sparked outrage in Washington, especially among Democrats, who feared for their congressional majorities with midterms looming. Although the administration initially promised consequences for Saudi Arabia, Biden's national security advisor later stated that the relationship would be re-evaluated in a methodical, strategic, effective way. Meanwhile, the initial outrage from Congress appears to have dissipated, especially after the Democrats performed better than expected in the midterms. Is MBS fully rehabilitated? Theoretically, MBS could return to the United States if he chose, whereas previously there remained a question of whether doing so would put him in legal jeopardy. MBS has yet to return to the UK, even missing the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, an event that drew monarchs and crown princes from all other Arab kingdoms. It seems much of the world has decided to overlook MBS' responsibility for the gruesome murder, not to mention his many other human rights abuses. Although the administration's latest move is hardly surprising, it does beg the question, what would it take for Washington to finally rethink its relationship with Riyadh? Also, Guardian wrote in this regard, the Biden administration has told the U.S. court that Mohammed bin Salman should be granted sovereign immunity in a civil case involving the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, effectively ending the last-ditch attempt to hold the Saudi crown prince legally accountable for the 2018 killing. In a filing released late recently, the Biden administration said the crown prince's recent promotion to the role of prime minister meant that he was sitting head of government and accordingly immune from the lawsuit. The United States government has expressed grave concerns regarding Jamal Khashoggi's horrific killing and has raised these concerns publicly and with the most senior levels of the Saudi government. The Department of Justice said in its filing, adding that the U.S. had also imposed financial sanctions and visa restrictions related to the murder. It said, however, the doctrine of head of state immunity is well established in customary international law and has been consistently recognized in long-standing executive branch practice as a status-based determination that does not reflect a judgment on the underlying conduct at issue in the litigation. The government's filing included an attached letter from Richard Visick, acting legal advisor to the U.S. State Department, instructing the Department of Justice to submit a suggestion of immunity to the court. Legal experts say the U.S. government's position, which was filed to a U.S. district court, will likely lead Judge John Bates to dismiss a civil case brought against Prince Mohammed and his accomplices by Hatice Cengiz, the outspoken fiancée of Khashoggi. Dawn, a pro-democracy advocacy group that was founded by the murdered Washington Post columnist, was a co-plaintiff in the case, which said Prince Mohammed and other Saudi officials acted in a conspiracy and with premeditation when Saudi agents kidnapped, bound, drugged, tortured and killed Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Sarah Lee Whitson, Dawn's executive director, issued a scathing rebuke of the administration in the wake of its decision, calling it an unnecessary elective action that will serve only to undermine the most important action for accountability for Khashoggi's heinous murder. It's beyond ironic that Biden has single-handedly assured Mohammed bin Salman can escape accountability when it was President Biden who promised the American people he would do everything to hold him accountable. Not even the Trump administration did this, she said. In June, Bates invited the Biden administration to weigh in on whether it believed Prince Mohammed bin Salman should be granted sovereign immunity in the matter and agreed to give the U.S. government two extensions before demanding that it file its views by September 17th. A legal observer close to the matter said it has always been understood that even though the U.S. government is not a party to the civil claim, its views would be decisive, and that the judge in the matter would very likely proceed with the case or dismiss it, depending on the U.S. government's position. The Biden administration's decision, which in effect will extinguish Cengiz's last hope for justice, will likely be met with intense criticism by Democratic lawmakers on Capitol Hill, who have pressed the administration to take a tougher stance against its West Asian partner. One lawyer close to the matter said the decision was disastrous for accountability, for human rights, for impunity. The legal decision also makes clear that U.S. President Joe Biden has fully abandoned the campaign promise to hold Mohammed bin Salman accountable for Khashoggi's murder. It raises questions about Biden's public remarks last month, in which he said Saudi Arabia would face consequences for leading an OPEC Plus decision to cut oil production, a move that was seen by the U.S. administration as siding with Russia over the interests of American allies. People familiar with the matter said the decision was reached after a big debate at the top levels of the White House, with some senior U.S. officials arguing that it would be difficult to defend the Biden administration's claim that human rights are at the center of its foreign policy while simultaneously allowing MBS, as the Crown Prince is known, to skirt accountability for his role in the murder. Cengiz's lawyers have argued that she turned to the U.S. courts for help because no other forum, including her native Turkey, had an independent enough judiciary to freely adjudicate her complaint. Mohammed bin Salman has denied he had personal involvement in the Khashoggi murder. It has been clear since June that the future of the case hinged on the question of whether, in the eyes of the U.S. government, MBS, widely seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was considered a sovereign like a president or king, since in most cases sovereigns are considered immune from U.S. lawsuits. When Biden first entered the White House, he declined to engage with MBS directly. His press secretary argued repeatedly at the time that Prince, though seen as Saudi's de facto ruler, was not Biden's counterpart. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies released an unclassified report that said Prince Mohammed bin Salman had likely ordered Khashoggi's murder. The president's stance changed last summer when he visited Jeddah and met with the Crown Prince, giving the heir to the throne a fist bump.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be looking at the recent elections in occupied Palestine, where there was a surge in support for the far right. The settler movement and its ultra-racist supporters have been jubilant about the outcome of the election. But is their hubris misplaced? Could the outcome of this election actually undermine the future of the Zionist colony? We'll be hearing from experts to get their thoughts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abu Chakra about the Knesset's new far-right parties.
He's back. Benjamin Netanyahu, the war criminal, mired in corruption allegations, is back at the helm of the temporary entity. The last time he was prime minister, over 3,500 Palestinians were killed by Israeli occupation forces, including 799 children and 342 women. His rule led to the destruction of over 8,000 Palestinian homes, leaving over 12,000 homeless. This time, though, he has some new allies with him. The alliance includes parties like Jewish Power, Noam, and Jewish Home. But let's take a look at some of the figures belonging to these parties who are likely to have a prominent position in Netanyahu's cabinet. Bezalel Smotrich lives in an illegal settlement on the lands of the village Kafir Qaddoum near Nablus. He has previously called for Palestinians to either live as servants to the Israelis or be killed. Smotrich is a co-founder of the Regevim organization, which descended alongside armed groups onto the Palestinian city of Lid in the temporary entity to squash the Unity Intifada in May 2021. Ofer Sofer is another figure tipped for big things in the Netanyahu government. He was previously a part of Likud and pushes to increase the military budget and Judaize Palestine. He was previously an infantry major in the Israeli military and will play a key role in the coalition. Alman Cohen is a member of parliament for the Jewish Power Party. He went from the Israeli military to the SWAT team in the police of the Zionist entity. He founded an armed militia to stalk the Palestinians in the Naqab in May of this year. Previously, he published a photo of himself in the military kneeling over a Palestinian father and his two sons with the caption, "Those down there remember what I did in the army." The sadistic caption was accompanied by a winking emoji. Another key ally to the Netanyahu regime is Simcha Rothman from the National Union Party. He has lived in the illegal settlement of Gush Zion and is a part of the Temple Mount movement, which explicitly calls for the destruction of Al-Aqsa. Perhaps the most well-known ally to the Netanyahu regime is Itamar Ben-Gvir, the militant Israeli settler who was spotted recently wielding his gun in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. He is known to have had a picture of Baruch Goldstein in his home, enjoying pride of place. Baruch Goldstein, of course, is famous for his attack, killing 29 Palestinian worshippers in the Ibrahimi Mosque of Al-Khalil in 1994. Ben-Gvir is known to have campaigned as a Kahanist, the movement founded by Rabbi Meir Kahane, whose organization, the Jewish Defense League, is a designated terrorist group in the United States. He was also a member of the fascist Cash Party, which was designated a terror organization by the Zionist entity and even outlawed in 1994. He is now likely to be appointed as public security minister, where he will take charge of the Israeli military, despite being disqualified from enlistment in it because of his political affiliations. Ben-Gvir has even been charged over 50 times in the courts of the temporary entity, so much so that he became a lawyer to defend himself. He has called for the mass deportation of Palestinians and even politicians, which he believes has demonstrated disloyalty to Israel. So, as Zionist fascism escalates in occupied Palestine, so too must the resistance.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David is a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Dan Cohen. Dan is the founder of Uncaptured News, which is a multimedia investigative journalism operation. Along with the Grey Zone founder Max Blumenthal, Dan was responsible for the 2018 film Killing Gaza. The film documented Israel's 2014 assault on Gaza during the war chronicled its horrific aftermath. We recorded his contribution earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. We asked Dan if he could provide some context on how these far-right tendencies relate to the Kahanist movement.
The Kahanist movement can't be seen as some sort of aberration or separate ideological current than Zionism. Is the completely predictable and logical outcome of Zionism, of a settler colonial movement predicated on ethnic cleansing, predicated on exploitation of religious symbols for European nationalism. And so the kind of brutish face of Kahanism that we see coming into the fore of the Israeli political process today is something that has long been there and is simply the logical, it follows the logic of Zionism.
David, I mean, we've spoken about the Chabad movement on the show before, haven't we? I mean, how does it intersect, do you think, with the settler movement?
Well, the home of the settler movement, the kind of the cockpit of the settler movement, is Hebron. Hebron was a place which was settled initially by the Chabad movement some centuries ago, I mean, a long time ago, and they've been there ever since, even although many of the Jews were pushed out of Hebron after a massacre in 1929. But so Chabad has been very important to the settler movement in Hebron, and indeed it's also important in what's called the Hilltop Youth settler movement. So it's said by, for example, Shin Bet, the Zionist intelligence agency, that the Chabad followers are responsible for most, maybe up to 80% of the price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians, which are common in the West Bank.
Well, we then asked Dan about Simcha Rothman from the National Union Party, who's part of the movement that wants to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Simcha Rothman is one of the Israeli politicians who represent a sort of the most modern current of religious Zionism, and it's melding with the Kahanist movement, what used to be the most extreme fringe of that movement. He's one of several politicians that now embody the spearhead of Zionism today. You could look at Simcha Rothman, of course. You can look at Itamar Ben-Gvir. You can look at Bezalel Smotrich. All of these are figures who have risen from the fringes of the most extreme right wing of Israeli society and Israeli politics, and are now prominent politically and are unabashed in their goals, their stated goals to destroy the Al-Aqsa compound, expel all Palestinians, and build a so-called third Jewish temple in its place.
David, I mean, what's the significance of Ben-Gvir's activities in the occupied Palestine neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah?
Well, he lives near Hebron, so not near Sheikh Jarrah. I mean, it's 30 miles or so away. But he's been trying to provoke confrontations in Sheikh Jarrah, so he's been trying to set up an office. He's appeared there on a number of occasions, most recently with brandishing a gun, but it's not the first time he's been brandishing a gun in the neighborhood. So the idea is to heighten the contradictions, to create a provocation, which then leads to a conflict in which the police or the IDF are then involved.
Well, we also asked Dan about how we should understand Ben-Gvir and his supporters.
Itamar Ben-Gvir is a man who celebrated the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He is on video saying that they stole the emblem off of his vehicle and that they would eventually get to Rabin as well, which, of course, was done. Rabin was assassinated. Itamar Ben-Gvir venerates the mass murderer Baruch Goldstein, who murdered 29 men and boys and injured many others when he opened fire in the Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron. So he is a man who venerates mass murderers. But what is the fundamental difference between venerating that mass murderer and what mainstream Israeli society does, where you have monuments and streets named after the terrorist groups of the Etzel and Lehi and Haganah, the pre-state Zionist terror groups that paved the way for the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing in 1948. Those figures committed ethnic cleansings and crimes that were much more severe, frankly, in terms of quantity, than even Baruch Goldstein did in the Ibrahimi Mosque. So, again, Itamar Ben-Gvir cannot be separated from Israeli society and Zionist ideology that he comes from.
Well, David, I mean, what do we know about Ben-Gvir's actions around the assassination of the Israeli Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin?
Well, mere days before Rabin was assassinated, he wasn't even 20 at the time.
No.
He was involved in stealing a part of the Prime Minister's car and brandishing it on the television and saying, we got to his car, we can get close to him. It's a kind of a deliberate definite death threat effectively against the Prime Minister. So you can see the kind of waters in which this politician is swimming. He is there to provoke, there to outrage, and he's been, in many of the court cases he's been involved in defending people who have been involved in really vile ethnic cleansing attacks. So a key example is the Douma attack, where a Palestinian family were burnt to death, including an 18-month-old child. And he, of course, defended the people involved in that, and he's defended many other people who are involved in terrorism, ethnic cleansing, deliberate attacks against Palestinians. So that's his politics.
No, indeed. Well, thanks for that. I mean, let's just pause there for a moment. This report on the decline of the so-called left in the Zionist entity and what it means for the future of the Zionist colony.
The election bringing Benjamin Netanyahu back to power highlights the rightward drift of politics of the entity. As a result, the Zionist so-called left has been totally marginalized, probably terminally. Labour, the party of First Prime Minister David Green, later known as Ben-Gurion, the Polish settler colonists gained only 4 seats, and Meretz, the party of the secular kibbutzim, didn't even make it into parliament. Labour and Meretz won a combined 44% of the vote back in 1992, the year Yitzhak Rabin was elected, and launched the so-called peace process with the Palestinian. It hit 13% in 2009, now it's down to just 7%. Of course, the term left is meaningless in the Zionist entity. The leftist Zionists were at the forefront of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians in 1948, and provided the cutting edge of the kibbutz system. Many in the West have wrongly seen the kibbutzim as socialist experiments, but there were always racist endeavors, admitting only Jews and built on stolen Palestinian land. The idea of right versus left blocks in the Knesset is misleading. In fact, when it comes to the Palestinians and the occupation, it is difficult to distinguish the right from the left. It was David Ben-Gurion who, after all, argued directly for the Nakba. We must expel the Arabs and take their places, drive them out. We must do everything to ensure they, the Palestinians, never do return. Today, justification for ethnic cleansing and genocide are rife across the Zionist political spectrum, from the left to the right and the far right. Here are some examples given by the journalist Ben White. I do not think that Arabs want peace. What I want is to be rid of them and to maintain a Jewish majority in the land of Israel. Only the strong winds and parts of Gaza were sent back to the Stone Age. I'm happy to be a fascist. Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and them alone. None of these statements were made by fascist right associated with Ben-Gvir and the other newly elected parties. As the politics of the temporary Zionist entity surges to the right, the end of the Zionist dream is increasingly in sight. Zionism is crumbling from within as it moves ever closer to a new fascism. The Zionists are not a trustworthy or reasonable partner for peace. Even collaborator Abbas of the Palestinian Authority has come to this conclusion. The only option for the Palestinians is liberation. The power of organized Zionism must be broken. The resistance is poised to play its role in destroying Zionism from the outside.
David, that film there was quite revealing. I wonder whether you could say a little bit more about your opinion about the decline of the so-called left in Israel. And also, can you say a word or two about the kibbutz movement? Because, you know, many people in the UK left seem to think that it's a, you know, it's been a genuine experiment in socialism. So just give us your thoughts on those two points, would you?
Well, I mean, I think the decline of the left is something which has happened not just as a result of the politics of the Zionist entity, but because of the structure of colonization. They have to move towards the right, because the logic of the system is that they have to move towards ending the existence of the Palestinians. That's what the settled colonization of Palestine means. So that's the structural reason why the left really has to decline if they are to carry out their dreams of getting rid of the Arabs. But on the kibbutzim thing, well, you know, it was the left which started up the whole state of Israel, really. I mean, the main military force, the Haganah, was from the left. The right wing revisionist Zionist terror groups were minorities at that stage. The kibbutzim was the kind of cutting edge. The right were kept out of the kibbutzim because they believed in private property, and it was the left who believed in communal living, who were the cutting edge of that, because then it could seem like they all had a stake in this, and they could expel Arab labor. So from the very, very beginning, the kibbutzim were Jews only, and the purpose of them being leftist, in inverted commas, was so that they wouldn't have to employ Palestinians. Mm. And there we had apartheid from the very, very beginning, coming through the left, not from the right, not from the revisionists, but from the left. And that's the key thing that people made. Of course, Tony Benn, you saw that in the film, they're doing an introduction, a foreword to that book on the kibbutz. And that was one of the particular, the most left-wing kibbutzims that existed, run by a group called Hashoma Hatzair, which still exists. Of course, Tony Benn later in life became very critical of Israel, but back in the day, he was one of the people who was signed up to that idea that this is a socialist experiment. Never was.
Well, we asked Dan about the difference between the notionally left-of-centre political parties in Israel, like Labour and Meretz, compared to self-styled centrists, Likud, and far-right political parties.
There is no fundamental difference between the so-called left-wing, the so-called centrists, and the so-called right-wing parties in Israel. They are all Zionists, meaning they believe in colonizing the land of Palestine and maintaining its indigenous residents as, at best, second-class citizens or people to be expelled and killed. The only difference is in terms of how they see fit to carry out this project. The so-called Zionist left wants to maintain a more gentle, softer occupation of the West Bank, with Palestinians remaining docile in their sort of enclave separate from Jewish society. And for the Israeli military to be as soft as possible while still maintaining a program of total conquest. The centrists are basically, the center in Israel is essentially right-wing, in that it is hyper-nationalist. It believes that there is no compromise with Palestinians, and the center has now been joined by the far right. It has been sucked into the far right because of the so-called left's hypocrisy. The left in Israel has long said, "Let us just maintain this project. We'll be in conflict with the Palestinians, and we'll just use the military when we need to." But that reeks of hypocrisy for the Israeli right, for the Israeli masses. Why should we be in conflict forever? Why should we deal with suicide bombings or whatever kind of attacks on soldiers and citizens alike? Let's end this. And so they have come to basically agree with the hardcore Israeli right wing that says full ethnic cleansing, full conquest, dismantle the Palestinian Authority, which collaborates with Israel to repress Palestinian resistance, and let's not be hypocrites.
David, what's the background to the radical settler movement that's centered in Hebron?
Well, the radical settler movement is dedicated to taking more and more territory from the Palestinians. In Hebron in particular, there's been a historical dispute going back almost a century now over the Ibrahimi Mosque, which is also known to the Zionists as the Cave of the Patriarchs. And this is supposed to be where Abraham and his relatives are buried. So this used to be simply a mosque for Muslims, but it's been, for some years now, it's been a joint use facility, if you like. So it's half a synagogue and half a mosque. And there's a massive conflict there over that. Of course, they, just like in Al-Quds, they want to take over Al-Aqsa, they want to take over the Ibrahimi Mosque. Now, there are something like 20 or 30,000 Palestinians in Hebron, and only a much smaller number of settlers. So it's a really focused conflict, and it's been a focused conflict for a very long time, in particular starting in 67 when some of the Zionists, the settlers, came back to Hebron after they'd been expelled in 1929.
Well, we also asked Dan where he thought Zionism was actually heading.
Zionism is reaching its logical conclusion. The hypocrisy of the establishment, of wanting to live a sort of European bourgeois lifestyle, while the masses are sent to fight in the army and then to come back and live in a kind of neoliberal hellscape where they have no possibility of